Hi. Okay, ready to start? Take your time. Okay, I think we stopped somewhere around here, discussing differentiating characteristics of CPS. So repurposed beyond applications that were their basis for design. We discussed the case of the smartphone. CPS are noted for enabling cross-domain applications, and then again, there are several examples that can be used here between telecom and power or between different sets of critical infrastructures. And what is important about CPS is that the impact they have on the physical world brings about concern about trustworthiness. Now, this is a new word. We have not defined what trustworthiness means. For the time being, keep it at the general, let's say, context meaning that the word has. But keep in mind that what a trustworthy system is needs to be discussed. And we will come back to that concept of trustworthiness. But not to the full extent. So we will discuss trustworthiness and its components. But for example, how do we ensure that the system is trustworthy is a question which is an open research question. Still, then there is more. Because this characteristic of CPS, the desirable characteristic that they should be able to form systems of systems, they should be also freely composable. And because of their very different nature, because by now you must have realized that CPSs range from something which can be tiny to something that can be huge. So from a wearable device or even from a small embedded system in an automobile to a large infrastructure. And therefore, computational models are different, obviously. And by computational models here, it is meant the difference in the, among other things, but mostly the difference in the processing capacity that each device has. Obviously, the processing capacity of an embedded circuit is much less than what it is for a large-scale computer. And also a variety of modes of communication. I think we've discussed this before. The world is not all IP. In fact, there is a very big portion of the world, particularly in industry, which is not IP. There are other means of communication, other protocols of communication, and therefore these should be able to support all these different modes of communication. Now, because of that, by now, it must have been clear enough that CPS are quite homogeneous, unhomogeneous systems, inhomogeneous systems, right? Heterogeneous. Because of all that. And therefore, heterogeneous systems, by definition, are complex. And this, of course, adds to the concerns about trustworthiness, one of the parameters of which is security. Another important characteristic that even though with traditional, let's say, IT systems, time is, of course, important, but it is not always crucial for the operation of IT systems. In our case, there is always a time-sensitive component, and this is because the interaction with the physical world has to be in real time or near real time. If you have something that needs to interact with the physical world, interact meaning that it gets information from the physical world, it decides on some action to be taken, and then communicating this action to the physical world back for the action to be enforced, that means that you cannot wait for long before all this loop is concluded, and therefore time is a concern. And also, another characteristic is that CPSs interact with the operating environment, being, in our case, the traditional, let's say, IT environment. Okay. Now, a series of models that we can use to model CPSs. This is the most general, let's say, one. So any CPS should have a cyber component. It should have a cyber physical component, and it should have a physical component. So here you have a physical component. It may have a wireless sensor or a wired sensor and actuators, and these communicate with the cyber physical component here. This is one box which is actually both cyber and physical, and then there is a purely cyber component on the other side which allows the communication of this CPS with other CPSs, with a control center, other networks, and so on and so forth. So this is the most generic, let's say, abstract model of that. Now there is four slides, I think, where we take this abstract model and give you examples of how this translates into four different categories of CPSs. So one is this. This is an industrial control system. Again, an abstract model, and how it maps into the abstract model of a general CPS. So the an industrial control system has, well, not one, of course, but several PLCs. These are programmable logic controllers that interact with the physical world. Well, here you may have, this is a fan or a turbine, whatever, right? So there are actuators here, and there are also sensors. These are not shown here. So there is communication between the PLC and the physical environment. This is the purely physical part of the cyber-physical system. Then this is the cyber-physical. And then, of course, the PLC is driven by a cyber component, which could be done either by remote access to the control center or through local networks and so on and so forth. And again, the point being that you can determine that the cyber component, the cyber physical component, and the purely physical component in this case. If you look at another example, this is the smart grid. Again, as a cyber physical system. So what do we have? Well, we can start on the production side. There's a generation plant that generates energy, of course. Then you have the transmission system and the distribution system. There is a box here, which is called the meter data management system. It's this part of the overall system that collects the measurements from the end users on the energy that they are using, integrates them, and starts billing and all that kind of thing, which includes the MDMS, the advanced metering infrastructure head end, a historian, and other things. That this is just a high-level depiction as well. So this is demand and response box that would decide according to the demand that it looks, how the amount of energy that is provided will be regulated. And here you have the end users, could be homes, could be anything, any end user of electricity, of course. There is a smart meter in each one of them. And this connects either wirelessly or by wire to a central point, which is called collector, which then communicates with the distribution control center. So this is a simplified architecture of what the smart grid and the advanced metering infrastructure looks like. So here, this, of course, is a system of systems, right? Because each one of them, of these large chunks, can be considered to be a system. The question is, can we identify again the cyber physical, and the physical components here? Well, this is cyber. This is only computation, nothing else. Right? Then this is cyber physical, because the advanced metering infrastructure looks at the energy consumption, and it communicates, of course, it has a cyber component that calculates things before sending them out. And then you have cyber physical components here as well, purely cyber component, collector, cyber physical, and so on. What is the physical, the purely physical component here? Any suggestions? A CPS should have a cyber physical, and a physical component. What is the physical component? Well, all of these are physical components, right? I mean, this is the physical world, your homes, and also these are physical things, right? The physical part of the smart grid. Okay, another example. Medical devices. We already discussed a little bit about medical devices. So in this case, and these are two examples here of medical devices. One is the CGM. This is one part of the insulin pumps that I mentioned. So there are devices. It can be a device that it only monitors your glucose levels and it doesn't release any insulin. But it can be an insulin pump as well. So this can be complemented with a device that will release the right amount of insulin. And another example, here is an insulin pump as well. Yep. And another one is what they call in medicine the ICDs, implantable cardioverter defibrillator, which is a device that is usually implanted in people that run a high risk of sudden death because of their heart stopping, because of specific pathological causes. And sometimes it is being used as a pacemaker or it complements a pacemaker. What is interesting to note here is that with all these implantables, we are very quickly moving towards the cyber cop or the cyberman. Okay. And in fact, you know, I think that NTNU has one of the strategic research areas is the cyber org, bringing together biology and medicine and computer science. So it's a nice field, but of course it has huge security problems. Okay, so this is the patient or the human being there, and of course this is the physical part of it. Now these are the cyber physical devices, okay, and then you have the purely cyber part of it, which is probably a computer sitting in a hospital, and in front of the computer, of course, you have the physician that monitors the situation of the patient. I think the last example is smart cards as cyber physical systems, in which case an architecture. The typical architecture of a smart car is like this. Of course, there is the physical part of the system, which is the motor. Then you have several sensors here. This would be cyber physical here, but also there can be a connection to the outside world through Bluetooth, through wireless, through whatever you want. And in this case, this is the cyber component. There is a central gateway in the smart car, which is cyber physical. And examples of systems that are connected to the gateway are the TPMS. That's the tire pressure monitoring system. So it's a system that monitors the pressure in your tires and lets you know what's going on there. And the remote keyless entry, and of course there are many more. You can have the entertainment system there connected to the gateway and so on and so forth. The reason I gave you these examples, and they all come from the same paper, which is this one. It's a good survey of the cybersecurity issues in in cyber-physical systems, is because the discussion on threats and vulnerabilities and so on that will follow, which is also from this paper, is guided by these four examples. So we'll be looking at the overall, let's say, CPS issues and threats and vulnerabilities, and then into each one of these four examples. And of course, you can use the same line of reasoning if you get another example of a CPS to analyze, then the same line of reasoning can be used in that one. Okay. Moving now from the abstract model, there is also a conceptual model that we can use for CPSs. The important thing to see here is this. In any CPS, be that a device or a system or a system of systems, but starting from the bottom hierarchical level, which is the device, there has to be that kind of cycle. There is, of course, the interconnection of the physical and the cyber world, and then on the physical world is characterized by a physical state. This provides information which goes into the cyber world, and some decision is being taken, which decision is communicated back to the physical world in terms of an action that needs to be performed. And this goes on and on and on. Obviously, there are interactions with the outside environment, and there are interactions with the human. The important thing to realize here is that this kind of model is actually recursive, because this could in itself entail another device, and the other could entail another device, and so on and so forth. The same, of course, applies for system and system of systems. Last model, architectural model, not abstract, not conceptual. Now we have another one, a functional one, later on, is this. There are three layers that you need to distinguish in every CPS. There is what we call the perception layer. The perception layer is that part of the CPS that gives you information about the condition of the physical part of the system, of the physical world. So you have sensors. You may have RFID there. You have actuators. You have anything you can imagine. These are just examples. Then there is a transmission layer, which takes care of transmitting the information that is being produced or perceived at the physical layer towards the upper layer. And the transmission layer can be Wi-Fi, it can be Bluetooth, it can be wired connection, it can be the internet or a LAN or whatever. And finally, there is the application layer, and here these are very few examples, and some of them we have already seen of what applications we can have of CPSs. Going into, I would say, a more operational kind of architecture, which we will also use when we discuss intrusion detection on CPS, is this. Again, starting from the physical world, what we have down here is what we call remote terminal units. These are units that can be either sensors or actuators or both, sensing and controlling the physical environment. The communication means with the upper layer, as you can see, is not IP, usually. These are protocols that are being used in industry, particularly Modbus and DNP3 are two industrial protocols, and CAN is the dominant, I would say, protocol in smart car applications. Have you ever come across those protocols in any of the courses you've already had? No. Well, you will have, I think, session 5 with Stephen. He will discuss, I think, Modbus mainly. Not all of them, of course. That doesn't make sense, but he will give you a good overview of Modbus, if memory serves. Okay, so, and then, the next architectural layer is the data acquisition systems. Examples of this can be a SCADA system, but not necessarily a SCADA system. It can be simpler than that. And here is where the IP stack comes in. So then you have TCP communication to the upward level, which is the MTU, the master terminal unit, and then, of course, it's the human-machine interface. So this is the cyber world, and this is the physical world. physical world, not IP. Cyber world, predominantly IP, if not exclusively IP. Okay? This is not to go through in detail. It's only to give you one vision of the Internet of Things. All the major companies have a vision of the Internet of Things. This is just one. And as I said, it is only intended to give you a visual of the broad scope of what this thing entails. Practically, everything. So the vision is that in some years from now, there will be no internet as we know it together, as we know it today. There will be this thing, which encompasses internet and also things and things like that. Or if worse comes to worst, the internet of everything. So connected humans as well, with implantables that can open your door. By the way, have you come across this? There has been an experiment in the UK a few years ago. An implant, which of course is being used for identifying and authenticating a human. And it has been used to unlock doors, of course, and you know, cars and things like that. Just goes under the skin. I mean, the principle is nothing much, right? Yes. They use it, of course, on pets for some years now, dogs and cats. The interesting thing about the experiment is not about the technology, because the technology is there. The interesting thing about the experiment was how humans behave when they have that kind of implant. And in fact, it's been some time since I read the article, but if memory serves, the person that came with the idea tested it on himself. So this was not a broad experiment, but he did test it so that he could give a proof of concept that this can work. But I guess this is a very interesting subject, not in terms of technology or of information security or of cybersecurity, but in terms of human behavior in relation to the human's interaction with technology. So Big Brother is coming of age, I think. Even indirectly. Okay. An example of one of these, all of these. It's somewhere, it's here. Okay. Somewhere in there. So this is a smart transportation system. The reason I'm going into detail into that is to show you the extent of this smart system of systems concept and how complex a CPS system can be. So first of all, and I think we referred to this in the morning as well, there are several modes of transportation. So you have road transportation, you have train, you have boat, and you have airplane. Immediately, this is one layer of a system of systems analysis of this. But then, even if you concentrate, for example, on the road infrastructure, right? Well, what are we going to have? We already have it, but more prominently in the next in the coming years. Well, we will have autonomous vehicles, right? Smart cars, but driverless. These things already exist. There are several driverless buses around the world already operating. Not passenger vehicles, as far as I know, but they do exist. When you have them in abundance on highways, what you would expect is that you would need to have a navigation system for them, and also you would need to have a crash avoidance system on them, right? So that they wouldn't crash into each other. Any security challenges there already? Then you have traffic signs that can be intelligent. And they regulate the time that they allow traffic one way or the other, depending on the traffic flow, and on weather conditions, or on other conditions or emergency situations, and so on and so forth. You can also have fleet management. You need to have some safety systems there. Of course, tolls are already there. Passenger information centers that would distribute information about passengers and so on and so forth. Each one of those individual things that I mentioned is actually a cyber-physical system. And all of them together, orchestrated, make what we call smart transportation. Now, if you take smart transportation together, if you take smart energy together, if you take smart health, if you take smart banking, is there a thing like smart banking? Well, I'm not sure. Maybe not. Maybe not. Then you come up with what is called smart cities. Smart cities. Okay? Are you familiar with the concept? Smart cities? Come on, you're not familiar with very sexy terms in the literature now. I mean, everyone speaks about smart cities. Google smart cities and you'll find out I'm not sure whether it will be the first hit, but IBM has announced, I think, 16 cities around the world that they intend to, through a project they have started, to turn into smart in the coming 10 years. So the idea is increasing the intelligence in all these systems. Unfortunately, what is not mentioned usually in the context of smart cities or smart transportation or whatever is the fact that I think that as we increase intelligence, we also increase our security challenges. And the question is, can we hit a balance between the two? I don't think there's an answer yet. Okay, again, at the systems of systems, back to the systems of system discussion, this is another view of the same story. So the physical layer, the cyber layer, and then the internet of cyber-physical systems. I won't go through in detail with that figure, but you can work it out yourselves. The thing here is that you have several items on each layer, several means of communication, and the legend is over here. You can work out your own examples on how a specific CPS, perhaps a critical infrastructure, can map onto these levels and what each one of them would be. Okay, so text instead of figures again. Again, if we look at it at the abstract level, we can have CPSs to actuate, to enable, to monitor, or to control flow of energies. This is a very common application of a CPS, like in the electric grid. The flow of materials, look at the case of a smart oil pipeline, if there is that kind of thing. Well, it doesn't have to be smart. But of course, controlling the flow in an oil pipeline is, by definition, a cyber-physical system, right? The same with freight transportation. If this is thought of in a maritime environment, this is one of the hottest topics today. The maritime industry has discovered that it is vulnerable to security, cybersecurity. Well, they have been a little bit slow in doing so. Fortunately, there have not been many incidents yet with the maritime industry, or the maritime industry seen as a critical infrastructure, because it is in several cases. But they are catching up fast. The nice thing about the maritime industry is that they have lots of money, usually. So when they decide to act upon something, then money is not a problem. And if you consider the fact that security is usually less than 10% of the budget in any operation, you can imagine what kind of budget we're talking about if you want to have a cyber-secure ship. I mean, it costs billions of dollars to build it. Okay, I mean, 5% for that to secure it, it's peanuts. And this is why they are hot, and they want the solutions today. If you Google maritime security and shipping things and autonomous ship security and all that, it's full everywhere. There are conferences everywhere. Okay. Transformation from materials to objects, like, for example, in mining, in manufacturing, in a more general setting. Then we can use them to move objects, autonomous vehicles, robots, traffic control, and so on. An interesting subject, again, I'm giving you hints for term papers. Cybersecurity of robotics. Is it interesting? I don't know. Household applications of robotics today, right? This is what we are moving towards. A typical one is, of course, those robotic machines that cut the grass in lawns, right? Well, I wouldn't imagine much of an impact if somebody hacked those appliances. Not much. But on the other hand, if you had a robotic application in a household that would possibly serve humans in other ways, like assisting disabled people or things like that, then there can be considerable impact on this. And I'm not saying that out of the top of my head, because I have seen publications about robotics and cybersecurity. Challenge is there. Okay. Flow of signals, like in air traffic control. Project that is already ongoing in Norway as well, I think, is the implementation of the concept of the remote airport. Have you heard about that? Okay, what is the problem? How many airports are there in Norway? Dozens. Because of the shape of the country, there are several, right? How many flights does each one of them have every day? One, two, maybe? I mean the smaller ones, right? Okay. Does it pay to have a full crew running the airport, to have them there for the whole day, for two flights a day, or maybe one flight a day? No, right? So what is the typical solution now, the traditional one? Well, you have them on a part-time basis, and they move in before the flight, and then they move out before the flight. What's the next step? Get rid of them. And what do you need the personnel for? Well, of course, you need air traffic control. You can take care of that remotely, right? You need to, of course, have some people to unload the aircraft, to refuel it, and things like that. You cannot do away with this immediately. But certainly we will agree that there will be several tasks that can be automated and come up with a much less need for personnel. This is a driving factor. And in fact, this is exactly the same driving factor for moving into what we call the autonomous ship. The reduction in the number of people serving the crew. Okay? It's going on. Come again? All sectors of society, exactly. Yeah, it's happening. It's happening in all sectors of society. And of course, there is the ongoing discussion on whether this will reduce the number of employment positions available and what the impact will be on society, of course. But, I mean, yes, this has always been the dilemma. Do we move ahead with technology or don't we, because we want to retain employment? The answer, of course, is that with technology you don't really reduce the number of workplaces, but you transform them to a higher degree of work. Conversion of energies, like in the case of, let's say, electricity production. Now, some CPSs may operate on their own, but others need to operate in orchestration. A good example is, again, the smart car thing, where you have something like hundreds of CPSs within a modern car already, not an autonomous vehicle, but already. I think somebody had quoted to me the number of lines of code that a modern automobile has. Any guess? Make a wild guess. I don't know. I don't remember the number, but I do remember the order of magnitude. Would it be, I don't know, 1,000 lines of code? 10,000? Yeah, it's several million. That's the order of magnitude, which is, I mean, it was surprising to me when I first came across it. It's the number of embedded systems that are there. Okay. Yes. And of course, they are connected. They can connect. They can interact either in the cyberspace or in the physical space or in both. And again, emphasize the dynamical environment in which this can be done. This is again another view. Let's forget about it. It's only functional domains, and it's the information flow between the, let's say, cyber domain and the cyber physical domain. I won't bother you with that. Okay. A look into the crystal ball. So what will the evolution, the likely evolution will be? If our estimate would be that these things are likely to go away, no need to study them. No need to study their security either. But this is not the case. What is happening and what we are witnessing is that, first of all, we are shifting from automation to autonomy. What's the difference? Is it clear to you? What's the difference between something which is automated and something which is autonomous?
Able to learn.
Autonomous is able to learn. Automated is not able to learn. Yes. There are several differences. It's not only one. But this is one, yes. Which practically implies a series of other things. Or another, if from another viewpoint, because other things need to happen, there is the need to be able to learn. Okay, and if we take the latter view, you want an autonomous artifact to be able to react efficiently and effectively in situations that have not been foreseen. That's the difference between the automated task, right? The automated task, it has been pre-programmed. We know all the situations that it will need to face. And it's simply kind of a lookup kind of thing. This is the situation, this is what I do, right? But an autonomous artifact should be able to face situations which have not been presented to it before. And this implies that it should have the ability to learn, right? Otherwise, it cannot do that. This can be done. We already have autonomous artifacts, like autonomous cars, and we're moving towards autonomous ships and so on and so forth. But this also raises some concerns. This is not the next bullet, but I think it's some bullets down the line. But this is one trend. So automation moves to autonomy. Increased connectivity, horizontally and also vertically. What does that mean? Horizontal connectivity allows them to collaborate between them. And vertical connectivity gives us the possibility to realize a global view because they communicate and they interact across domains. Okay, now, I already warned you to keep in mind the autonomy versus automation distinction. And I want to connect it now to link it to the trustworthiness issue. So what is trustworthiness? I had promised to give you a definition. It's the demonstrable likelihood that the system will perform according to designed behavior under any set of conditions as evidenced by characteristics, including trustworthiness, includes, but is not limited to safety, to security, to privacy, to reliability and resilience. So if a system has all these nice characteristics, then we can say it's trustworthy. Hmm? How do we achieve that? Well, we do know how to approach safety. We do know how to approach security and privacy. That's our domain, right? We do know how to approach reliability, and we do know how to approach resilience. Would you go about studying a single system, studying its characteristics with all these axes separately? Would that be a good idea, and then combine the results and come up with a design for your system? Well, the answer is already there. And the answer is that we can take, of course, traditional approaches, but it's not possible to combine the result of individual approaches. What we need is a need for a cross-property approach that would look at all of them together. This we don't have yet. If you want to pursue glory, go ahead. It's an open domain. It's not an open issue. How do we come up with approaching all these at the same time? Okay. This brings us into part two. But before going into that, and since we have a couple of minutes before breaking, that automation versus autonomous discussion. And again, intelligence. Is it possible that by imitating intelligence, we will also imitate situations? Because intelligence is something which is inherent to humans, right? But humans also are known to suffer from problems because of their intelligence. An example is what happens to a human when he's presented with a situation where there are two conflicting goals. What do we do? Well, a normal person normally takes some approach so that they can consolidate the two goals, or not, if not, to prioritize, forget about one, and then try to satisfy the other one. Okay? A normal person. And there are several ways of doing that. But it can lead to situations where you try to satisfy both goals, and this leads you to practically something which is schizophrenic, because you're trying at the same time to pursue two different goals. And of course, this is not a nice situation, and it may lead to real disorders. Now, is it possible then that since we are trying to imitate the way humans operate, have machines that operate in this way, is it possible that we will end up with machines that may run the risk of, in situations like this, will go berserk? Crazy? Weird? It's a risk. I don't think that anyone has demonstrated that this can happen, because we have not yet reached the point of autonomous systems that are that intelligent that could pursue autonomously different goals. I don't think so. But this is something that was prophesized 40 years ago. Have you seen the movie Odyssey 2001? Remember what happened to HAL, the onboard computer? This was an autonomous machine, right? And what happened to him? Well, he had been given two conflicting goals. One was the success of the mission, and the second was the protection of the crew. And he realized that he couldn't do both, and he simply went schizophrenic. So if this is a look into the future, it may be not a very good future anyway. But this is cybersecurity related. So again, if you want to be glorious, we can talk on this. Okay, break, and then we come back in 15 minutes. Okay, perhaps we can start. Then we're coming into the discussion of, since we have hopefully agreed that there are several differentiating characteristics of CPSs that differentiate them from traditional IT systems, then that would mean that, and we have already discussed the trustworthiness issue, that would mean that there are some cybersecurity and privacy challenges that are specific to CPS, which we don't have in other kinds of systems. And that's what I want to go through with you now. And these are categorized, these issues are, or challenges are categorized into five distinct classes. One is what is called overarching issues, so generic things we cannot put into any one of the other classes. Then challenges that come because of the interaction of the CPSs with the physical world. Challenges that are due to their operational constraints. Challenges due to their life cycle. And finally, some privacy challenges. These are not due to something, but they are separate from cybersecurity challenges. So starting with the overarching issues, well, one overarching issue is addressing the requirement for resilience. We have talked about resilience before, and I remind you that it is one of the dimensions of trustworthiness. Just a distinction between what really ability is and what resilience is. So if you look at really ability engineering, what the aim of this is to ensure predictable system performance, or in other words, that the system will behave as it was intended to or designed to. And it will be within the limits of safety in predetermined conditions. That means that reliability engineering addresses risk in situation where the distribution of possible outcomes is known. So we know in advance what can go wrong, or we assume what can go wrong, and then we design the system so as to have the expected behavior in these a priori known situations. Okay. That's reliability. Well, resilience, on the other hand, is intended to address uncertainty. So as opposed to reliability. So in fact, it deals with situations where the distribution of the possible outcomes is not known. That's where we want resilience. When something goes out of what has been expected. A possible cause for that is because the environmental conditions are not well understood, or they are even completely unknown. Okay. And of course, these environmental or operational conditions can be either changed by physical causes or by accidental causes, but also the change can be the result of an intentional manipulation, which of course is not benign. And this is where cybersecurity comes in. Okay. Fine. Now, second challenge. So what is the challenge here? The challenge is, these are the titles of the challenges, to address the requirement for resilience in cyber-physical systems. Okay. Second challenge. It derives from what we call the CPS continuum. We already discussed one aspect of the continuum by saying that CPSs can be tiny systems, small controller in your automobile, up to the smart grid itself. But this is another continuum. We have safety critical systems, like what? What's an example of a safety critical CPS? Come on.
Traffic lights?
Traffic lights, yes. Traffic lights is one. Anything else? Well, I would guess that the system that controls the launching of the nuclear arms in North Korea is a safety critical system. Perhaps not for North Koreans, but for the rest of the world it is. Okay? So yes, traffic lights is a safety critical system, but I can come up with really more nasty examples. But keep in mind that both those examples, they're large-scale ones, right? Okay, I'll come to that. So safety critical systems are those whose failure could result in loss of life. So a train is also a safety critical system. If it fails, then people may lose their lives. Or significant property damage, or damage to the environment. And these are examples of safety critical systems. Okay? Now, because they are safety critical, usually such systems are highly regulated. I'm not sure that the North Korean example is one of the highly regulated ones, but as I said, this is usually the case. And they are the product of careful design and usually of much money. That's the one end of the continuum. What's the other end of the continuum? Well, consumer convenience or entertainment devices, right? So this is what? Your wearables, what we were discussing in the morning, the thing that the gadget that measures your paces you've covered, right, or meters you've covered in a day. There are no limits on access, usually. They are produced in a variety of development environments. What is mostly common is that most of them are produced in China, but otherwise there are different environments, usually. I don't think that this is a reference to the Chinese development environment, that it is unstructured. This is not the case. It pertains to something else, I'm sure. And usually at a low cost. And they are usually disposable. Even though something like that may cost us several hundreds of euros, it can be considered as composable. So you can see that these are the two ends of a wide spectrum, and we have everywhere in between. But why is this a challenge? Well, see what the problem is. That because of that characteristic of CPSs that we have already discussed, that systems are being used for purposes other than those that they have been originally designed, we are witnessing a conversion, a convergence of such systems. Okay? So, for example, we have wearable or implantable medical devices. These are safety critical systems. An insulin pump is a safety critical system. But on the other hand, you can also consider it as, well, of course not as an entertainment, but as a consumer convenience device. And that doesn't mean that they are designed with the same level of protection, like physical protection or cyber protection. So this is the second challenge then, that we need to come up with ways of addressing cybersecurity and privacy in a wide spectrum of uses. Some of those systems, there is an inherent in the operation environment, in the development environment, inherent awareness of the need for security. Those are the critical, safety critical ones, and the others where nothing like this attitude exists. So this is a second challenge, overarching one. Third challenge, the system of systems nature. Now here, it is important to realize that such a system is not necessarily designed as a coherent thing. And in fact, we already said that it can be dynamic. So don't look in all cases for a blueprint of a system of systems. There is none. Simply things putting together, well, not in an unstructured way, but certainly not, in most of the cases, in a pre-designed way. So this is why there are opportune connections among systems in this case. And what is this problem? Well, you know how to secure two interconnected systems when you know what the behavior of these systems are in advance. But what is the situation with cybersecurity when you are called upon to secure a system that has a component which you had not anticipated when you designed it, and which can operate in a way that is unpredictable? This is the challenge here. Well, this is exactly what we have discussed already. Now, there is an extra twitch to the complication here, to the challenge here, an extra complication. Well, sometimes the system of systems consists of components that do not belong to the same entity. What does that mean? We don't know who is responsible for the security of each one of them. Well, we know who is responsible for each one of them individually, but who is responsible for the overall? And responsibility is not simply a managerial concept here, but it is also the technical responsibility of ensuring the correct or trustworthy operation of a system that results as a combination of two other systems that belong to different entities. In other words, what is in whose domain of control does the overall system belong when you have two different systems coming together with two different individual domains of control? Is the question clear? And what the problem is? You do know the term domain of control, right? Yes or no? Domain of control is the domain over which we, as security officers, let's put it this way, we can apply our controls, and therefore we can apply whatever security controls we have come up with from our own design. So, for example, just one simple example to understand what the domain of control is. If the system you're studying or designing in terms of its security is an IT system, a traditional IT system that, of course, connects to an ISP at some time. Okay? There is a connection to the outside world through an ISP. Can you control the controls that the ISP will apply on the connection? Do you have any control over that? You don't, because it is not in your domain of control. Where is your domain of control? Well, it's the perimeter of your own system. It's that domain where if you decide that you need to do something, you can do it. Anything beyond that is not your domain of control. So you can probably visualize now what I'm saying here as a challenge, that you may have a situation like this. This is domain of control A of one system. Okay, entity A is responsible for this. You have another domain of control here of another system, and entity B has responsibility for the domain of control of the for the control of domain B, and then you put these together. In whose domain of control the overall thing fall? See the challenge? What would be your immediate reaction? What's the easy way out? Come on. It's a security engineering problem. Come on, you should be able to answer this. You may have not taught this, you may have not been taught this, but you should be able to face it. Come on, it's ingenuity. Come on, innovativeness. Yes? Okay. So another one. Yes. But remember, the response was another one. Yeah, okay. C, right, okay. This is one entity. Possibly, more frequently, a legal entity. And this is another entity. Okay? So this is what? It can either be one of those, or it can be a third legal entity. Right? Example. Suppose that this entity, this domain here, is the energy domain, the electricity domain. And this is the transportation domain. Okay? Trains. Right? So what is the system that comes together? Well, the system that composes both the electricity that provides the transportation system, and this provides the services of what we know as the train service, the railway service, right? Of course, in the energy sector, the energy provider is responsible for cybersecurity here. The NSB would be responsible for the security, the cybersecurity of the trains themselves. Who would have responsibility for the overall thing? Would it be the energy provider? Would it be the train service provider? Or would it be someone else? And who would that someone else be? This is why it is a challenge. If there was an easy answer, it wouldn't be a challenge. There is no single answer, first of all. But it's definitely not a good idea to decide on your own, if you are a decision maker, that this guy here will be someone, because that's the way I like it. It never works. There is a lot of negotiation processes going on where you're trying to consolidate things like that. Fine. Now, next challenge, extreme scalability. They can conquer the earth, right? We keep building new CPSs, connecting them to existing CPSs, and so on and so forth, up to infinity or up to the Internet of Everything. Now, this is a challenge, right? Because, of course, it's an unprecedented scale. We have huge networks of small sensors, and we have small networks of huge sensors. Not sensors, but if you look at the critical infrastructure, this is kind of a large thing, right? Okay, so you have all the variety there. Therefore, whatever security mechanism we come up with, they should be able to scale as well. What does that mean? One of the, let's say, chapters in solutions of information security is, of course, cryptography. Correct? I mean, it's a usual solution for several problems. Does it always scale? Well, no. That means that when you're faced with a cybersecurity problem in a situation like CPS, you just don't tick off the box by saying, okay, I can apply any solution given by crypto, like in authentication, like in key management and things like that, and it will work, because you have to make sure that it will scale well. As you will see, there is another problem here with crypto. In fact, there are several problems with crypto in CPS, but these all are challenges. So, scalability, which needs to extend to the scalability of security solutions as well. Well, next challenge is that we need to have systems that are resilient by nature, or, well, by design, or whatever. That means that they should be able, this brings us back to the intelligence discussion, right, to detect just one or more threats, but they should also be able to correlate the threats with the impact on the system behavior they have and decide accordingly on the line of action. Now, what we have today, the automation environments that we already have in place, is the result of an interconnection of CPSs on one hand, and on the other hand, the inability to anticipate and to prevent faults. This is the situation as it is now. So we need to go from this, let's say starting point, to this. Okay? This is a challenge by itself. Under the same challenge comes the what we call the benign human error. Benign human error we can usually take care of, but unfortunately there is not only benign humans. We all know that we have malicious humans. And in this case, the so-called perimeter protection is not enough anymore. And therefore, coming back, we need to design systems resilient, because as I have repeatedly said, you have to assume that the system will be attacked and it will be successfully attacked. Okay. Oh, this is the dichotomy problem that we discussed before breaking. Okay. If you have conflicting or multiple performance goals. This is the undesirable response that we talked about. Schizophrenia of a machine that is intelligent enough to understand that it should be pursuing conflicting goals. Okay. Before going into the challenges deriving from the interaction with the physical world, I had promised to you that I would remind you of the question whether you think that a processor is a cyber-physical system. So, what's your opinion? This is not fictitious. Huh? As I said, we had it in the context of a conference. And it was a heated discussion. Let me give you the arguments. Well, some of the arguments. I want to be fair, but I'll probably forget some. But the major arguments is this. The main argument in favor of a processor being a cyber-physical system. It has a cyber component, obviously. A processor, by definition, has a cyber component. But it also interacts with its environment, its physical environment. What is its physical environment? Probably the motherboard that it resides with, right? This is a physical environment. And does it interact with it? Yes, it does. It increases, for one thing, it increases the temperature, right? And other forms of interaction. So, according to this argument, just a minute before, let me give you the other arguments as well, okay? But this is the main one, okay? Now, on the other hand, the arguments against the processor being a cyber-physical system is, okay, where is that loop of interconnection between the physical world and the cyber world? So does the processor sense in some way the physical world around it? Does it make decisions depending on that information? And based on these decisions, does it then attempt to influence its physical environment? Remember that conceptual model with that circle? So this was the counter argument. Now, your views. Yes. I just gave an example. Let me repeat that. I mentioned temperature and I said yes, but this is my example. There might be a better example. Yes.
No, I just used that example.
Okay. Well, maybe if I come closer, we can get the sound. That's the good thing with the mobile.
It interacts with its surroundings by controlling this temperature. It has temperature sensors, and it can start fans to cool down. But the temperature here is not part of its actual mode of operation. So
yeah, correct. I mean, the analysis with regard to the interaction is correct. Because there are sensors, not in the processor itself, and this is, I think, an important detail. And also, the actuator is not in the processor. Okay, it's something apart. There is this interaction, but this is not the core functioning of the processor. This is not what the processor is doing, right? That's correct. Well, I don't know whether it has been evident, but I didn't agree that the processor is a cyber-physical system, so I may be biased here, but this is exactly why I want to discuss it with you. I mean, if somebody claimed that a motherboard was a cyber-physical system, that example with the temperature, it would have worked, because then components of that system do interact with the environment and they do control the environment. It would be far-fetched. I don't think that many people would think of a motherboard or of a laptop as a cyber-physical system, but it would be satisfying the conditions for such a thing. Okay, but the processor alone, I don't know. Well, again, I said I didn't want to bias you, but is there any argument in favor? Or maybe then we can conclude the discussion among us, and then I can take the discussion again with the people that we had it in the conference some other time. Okay, that's just to give you food for thought. This could be, for example, an exam question. I can come up with some crazy example and ask you whether this is a cyber physical system or not. That reminds me of an exam I had when I was a student about 40 years ago, as I said, when dinosaurs were walking outside. Was it linear algebra? I think so. Yeah, or maybe it was spaces, something on mathematics, anyway. And vector spaces, yes. And the question we had was whether a mixed salad is a vector space or not. Are you familiar with the definition of a vector space? Have you had any such sort of mathematics in your classes? Okay, it's interesting because, well, a vector space is a mathematical construct in which there are several characteristics, but one of them is that if you define operations between the elements in the space, then the result should be in the space again itself. No matter what kind of operation you define. So under this definition, is the mixed salad a vector space? Well, the way to think about it would be what? Well, a mixed salad has, let's say, lettuce, right? And it has what? Just pick another ingredient, whatever. Yeah, tomatoes, okay. So can you define an operation, any operation, between those two elements that would give you a result that it is part of the salad? There is no tomato lettuce kind of thing. I mean, you can't combine those two. If it was oil and vinegar, yes, because these two can mix, and then you come up with a mixture that is probably a member also of the set, of the space, right? But you cannot do that with all the ingredients, and therefore the answer was that it's not a vector space. I can't remember what my answer was in the exam, but I got a high grade in the course, so I guess I might have answered it correctly, hopefully. Anyway, so yes, I could ask you, is this a cyber physical system? And then the process, of course, for answering this would be that you would have to check if the characteristics that we have check and justify if the characteristics that we have discussed are there. Okay, coming back to the challenges. So, second set of challenges, those derived by the interaction with the physical world. Now, as opposed, let's say, to traditional IT systems, an attack on a CPS can be physically catastrophic. So, some of the examples, at least one of the examples that we discussed in the first session of incidents, the steel mill, right, the German steel mill, or the Stuxnet case, which you know, of course, they did result in physical destruction of assets, even though initially they could be considered just an IT traditional attack, right? A malware attack, that's what it was. Well, a malware attack against the IT infrastructure can be, of course, catastrophic, but it can never be physically catastrophic. Now, second point here, what that means, there should be a different level of tolerance when we're talking about CPS, and that's even more important, a different level of urgency in addressing attacks. So, for example, a DOS attack against any kind of IT infrastructure, yes, it will have impact. It may be a large impact, it may be financial loss, it may be anything you can imagine, any type of impact, but it is not compared by any means to the urgency of addressing a DOS attack against a safety critical CPS. And I think we can agree on that easily. Because human loss of human life will be evident for sure, or physical catastrophes will happen. And that means that we don't have all the time in the world to address such attacks. And by address, we mean what? We need to detect them fast, and we need to respond fast. And we need to recover fast. Or in other words, we need to have a resilient system. or in addition to. Now, sometimes this is not possible to physically secure all the components in a cyber-physical system. So this means that whatever cybersecurity processes we have, they may be operating in an already compromised environment. This is no good. We don't like that. Under the same chapter, and this is important, they are subject to the time constraints of the physical process they are executing. And this limits us quite significantly. I already hinted to you that cryptography can be problematic when we try to apply it in specific situations in CPSs. One example of that in the energy sector, or the smart grid sector, is this. Several researchers have proposed the use of cryptographic protocols for mutually authenticating devices in the grid. This is a typical solution. I mean, in any case that you would like to have mutual authentication between devices or computers, what would you do? Well, some kind of mutual authentication protocol, crypto, right? Okay. What about the bandwidth? And what about the time that you have available to do that? In a traditional IT system, well, you may not have all the time in the world, but definitely you have no real-time constraints. Now, in a system like the smart grid, if you want to authenticate a device and thus takes longer than a specified period of time, the result of not having concluded the authentication could be more catastrophic than it would have been if you didn't authenticate at all, simply because a relay will not switch or something different can happen, and then a transformer may be completely destroyed. These are only examples. Which means what? Well, we should come up with lightweight schemes that are specifically designed for situations with CPSs. A very typical example of this is also in smart cars. We can't afford to have a PKI based on RSA for authenticating vehicles to the infrastructure or vehicle to vehicle. That's practically impossible because of time constraints, let alone the computational resources constraints to which we will come later. In any event, time is crucial. We cannot forget about time when securing CPSs. Deadline sensitive. Okay, that means that what we have, the arsenal we have, we need to modify significantly. Another conclusion here regarding time is that we cannot afford to have solutions that have human in the loop. Now, this is not always like this. Sometimes we need to have a human in the loop. The argument there goes like this. Because we have time constraints and because these systems are deadline sensitive, so we have to react faster, that precludes the use of a human because the human is known to react slowly in cases, much more slowly than a machine. Okay? So this is the argument as it appears there. But on the other hand, there are many cases, particularly in safety critical systems, where you cannot rely on automated response simply because you want the human in the loop, because you want to have a consideration of factors that no machine can now have. It may have in the future, but not now. Have I ever told you the discussion we had with several colleagues here in the cafeteria about the autonomous car facing a risk situation? No. Okay. So, autonomous vehicle, driverless car, right? It comes to a point where there are two options to decide. There is a young lady trying to cross the road, and there is an old man on the sidewalk. So what is the decision? The vehicle is faced with the following scenario. it will either have to hit the young lady or the man on the sidewalk, because there is no time to brake. So it will have either to veer away or not to veer away. What's the decision algorithm? What would a human do? Let's take it from there. Let's agree that not all humans will have the same reaction, right? One human might go for the old man, and another one might go for the young lady. Hmm? But this is not important. What is important is the process of the decision making. What we are doing, obviously, and this is an everyday life situation, right? It may happen to all of us. We're actually calculating risks. Hmm? So this is the question. What is the algorithm for calculating the risk there? And of course, I have already simplified this because I have taken out the likelihood. It's the same in both scenarios. Otherwise, you could have escaped, right? You could say, I would go for the less likely scenario. But this is the same. So actually, what I'm asking you is to give an estimate of how you would come up with the impact, because that's the only thing that differentiates the two scenarios, right? Yes.
I was thinking not veering off the road because that might. I would probably program it to not veer off the road then, because that might endanger the person inside the car as well.
Suppose that you don't have anyone in the car.
There's no one in the car. Okay.
It's a driverless car, yeah. Right? It's just going somewhere to pick up someone. It's a taxi which you have called and it's coming to pick you up. Okay. There is a serious answer and there is a funny answer to this. But I can assure you that we did have that discussion in the cafeteria and we did a scientific analysis of the situation. Of course on the serious side, and then we came up of course with the funny answer as well. The calculation of the impact is a function of many parameters. So it should take into account the societal beliefs, the values of the society, the age of the people, probably. Well, maybe not. Maybe this is one of the values that comes into the discussion. Okay, but there I can give you a twitch. Suppose that the young lady was also pregnant, then you see that there is a differentiating factor here because we are actually comparing an impact of two lives against one, if this can be a measure, right? But in any case, the serious answer is that these are things that we do not really have answers to because we don't know how even a human would react, because there is no, for once, there is no universal response to scenarios like this. Hmm? What's the funny answer? Yes?
If age over 80 years old, drive left, for example.
Yeah. Yes, this could be one. I can give you a semi-funny answer. That's what we came up with. And this relates back again to the point that I make again and again, that eventually, unfortunately, it is usually decisions made based on a financial basis. Okay, well, you know that the cost of life is different among countries and among citizenships. So, for example, the cost of life in the UK is far less than the cost of life in Norway. Okay, so what is the criterion? You hit the British. Okay, because simply the insurance that you will have to pay will be much less than if you hit the Norwegian. Okay. It may not be that of a funny situation, you know, and I really wouldn't like to live in a world that this would not be a joke, but rather one of the criteria for deciding. Anyway, okay. Operational constraints. Another chapter of challenges, deriving from this. What do we mean here? Well, some of them, many of them, exist on resource-constrained platforms. Imagine a sensor actuator that tiny, which is part of a wireless sensor network and a wireless actuator network, right? What kind of computational capacity does that have? Minimal, right? So, resource constraint. It's not only computational capacity. It can have power resource, power constraints. They usually operate on batteries, right? And batteries are not there forever. In fact, there are several attacks called battery depletion attacks that do not aim at anything else but making a device exhaust its power supply and therefore result in a denial of service kind of situation. And how do you do that? Well, a simple way is to enforce, to make the device increase the traffic, because that's what it, the network traffic that it goes out of it, because that's how it consumes power, right? And again, there are several ways of doing that. Okay. So again, lightweight mechanisms in terms of storage space, of memory use, and so on and so forth. Second problem here on resource constraints, these platforms are distributed. And that means that individual components, even though they are local, they must perform global tasks using local information exchange. In other words, what that means is that a node in a large or a global CPS will have to make decisions and take actions based on a picture of the world that it's not the global picture, but it's the local picture. Now this, in control systems theory, which is one of the topics that you will be discussing with Stephen as well, can be addressed. We can have full observability of a system by looking at local information but other specific constraints. So that means that we can formulate a picture of the global world based only on local information under specific conditions, but this is not always the case. And when it is not always the case, then this is a challenge. How do we make a global decision based only on local information? Need to accommodate the in-place business processes. These systems do not operate in vacuum. They operate in business environments. What does that mean? Christian, this is your case. Access control in control systems.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to have an access control system in a process control center that would take even one moment to authenticate you in case of an emergency? You've read the paper, yeah, so you're better. I haven't read it. I've just gone through, right?
Yeah, probably not.
Probably not. Okay. You would have to come up with other solutions, okay? So, for example, in an IT system, what is your major requirement from an access control system? Few false positives, right? And few false negatives. Time is not of essence in most of the times. You can take some seconds to do that. And you can have dual mode authentication, you can have multiple mode authentication, so you can ask for a fingerprint, you can ask for a retina scan, you can ask for a password as well, and you can ask for a smart card as well. Okay, fine. Can you do that in a situation, and I'm taking you away now from process control rooms, in a hospital, and you're a doctor, you need to authenticate to a system because somebody is brought in and that somebody is bleeding to death. Is it acceptable that you go through all these nice security procedures and you authenticate yourself successfully, but oh, well, sorry, the poor guy died because you had to take some time to authenticate yourself. And unfortunately, these things have happened. Okay. Now, particularly in the healthcare environment, we know the solution. It's called the break the glass situations. break the glass by imitating the break of glass, the alarm signals in transportation, and so on. So you have an authentication system in place that satisfies all the requirements, the normal requirements of access control. And then if a medical practitioner believes that they have to bypass that, then they can. But what happens at the same time is what? Increased logging starts immediately. And then whoever did that, they will have to justify why they had to do it. Okay. Now, this is simply simpler to say than to do, but it is the solution, okay, in this particular case. It's only one example of how important the business environment, well, in this case, the medical environment, is important when you design your security solutions. It's not enough to come up with the best security solution if it cannot fit well into the business environment. So, yes, okay, examples like that. Strong passwords, yes, of course, if you enforce a password of 16 characters length, fine, yes, this is strong enough. Who can remember it? And so on and so forth. So in practice, even though I'm sure that you have been taught that this is something that we should never do, passwords are shared, and we have to live with that. Okay, and finally, final point here. We need to find mechanisms to establish trust between machines and people in the case of cyber-physical systems. There is another requirement on always on. That means that CPSs have to be on all the time, which means, well, yes, I know, we always recommend that we have all the latest patches in place. How can you do that when the system has to be on and you cannot afford to shut it down so that you can update it? Not trivial. Our recording will stop in 5 minutes, so I have to rush through that a little bit. I will arrange for an extra session of 2 hours at least after Stephen finishes with his session so that we can cover the remaining material. So look for announcements in Blackboard. I can't remember the dates now, but it should be somewhere in October. I will post an announcement in Blackboard. So, but at least let's go through the big chapters here. So always on, then the domain of use is dynamic. We have discussed the dynamic nature of the environment repeatedly. And then another chapter is the life cycle issues. What is the problem here? Well, the problem is that some of the CPSs have very long lifetimes, more than 30 years, sometimes even more than 40 or 50 years. What's the problem with this? Well, you can't expect to be updated every now and then, and that's one aspect of the problem. Another aspect, of course, is that the manufacturer might go out of business before the item goes out of commission, okay? And what do you do then? Well, this is a challenge. And finally, the last chapter is privacy challenges. Okay. Well, the big problem here, the big picture, is what? Through the operation of large-scale cyber-physical systems, we have access to large, huge amounts of data, which we have never had before. And that means that we can profile people, we can profile behaviors, we can do things that we could never do before because of the cyber-physical systems. And it's not only information of a personal nature, but it is also information on the interaction of individuals with the physical world, which makes the difference. So your wearable that counts the number of paces can be very well used to give information on your walking habits, for example. Why would that be useful? Well, you would be, for once, subject of targeted advertisement, for one thing. I don't think that if I had a wearable like that, anyone would target me, because I'm not a sportsy kind of guy. So they wouldn't probably target me for an advertisement of shoes for walking. But they might do that to you. and so on and so forth. And the impact is much bigger in privacy violations here, because we may result in risks that lead to physical harm as well. An example is, and this is again an open issue, is the privacy violations of the measurements of the advanced metering infrastructure in the smart grid, because then you can infer information about the behavior of a household when somebody starts the oven or turns on the lights or when having a bath or things like that. And of course, why is this a problem? Well, because they can also infer whether you're at home or not, which means the physical harm would be a robbery in this case. And these things can happen. Okay, as I said, I have to rush through that because the recording will stop. So, yes, 1 minute before stopping. And this is part three. Okay, as I said, we will have an extra session, so maybe we can go back in a little more detail when we have that, if, of course, you see the need of this. So what we're left with is threats, vulnerabilities, and attacks, then solutions, and then intrusion detection with cyber-physical systems. Okay? Yes. Don't forget the term papers, please. Thank you very much. Have a nice afternoon.